This year at the climax of TV's Night of Nights, the Logies, comedian Dave Hughes was preparing to announce the winner.
Here we, are we ready?
Of TV's most coveted award.
We're ready. Here we go.
The Gold Logie. The award voted on by the TV-watching public for the most popular personality on TV.
The TV Week Gold Logie goes to... Waleed Ali!
Waleed took a kiss from his wife Susan and claimed the award, and the crowd just went wild.
Do not adjust your sets.
Normally the Gold Logie goes to a soapy star or a lifestyle show host, but this time it was different. Never mind the fact that Waleed is a Muslim of Egyptian heritage and people from a non-Anglo background are pretty scarce on Australian TV, the thing that blew my mind was the fact that the public had spoken and given the Gold Logie to a public intellectual. The Gold Logie! Who knew Australians could do such a thing? I've met Waleed a few times, and he's been on Conversations before, but I've been wondering for a while now what he makes of the incredible year he's had. What does it mean when a bookish, thoughtful academic like Waleed can conquer the Logies with all the glitzy stars and the red carpet and the, oh my God, I'm stoked to be here stuff? When his video editorials can reach many millions of viewers all over the world through YouTube? I arranged a time to talk about this with Waleed in Melbourne, where he lives, but the ABC building was undergoing major reconstruction. So Waleed kindly invited me into his home, where we could talk about life, the universe and everything, and the incredibly weird year that he's just had. It's been some months now since you've won the Gold Logie for most popular personality on Australian TV. It's a thrilling moment watching the whole thing. And a lot was made, quite rightly, about the unlikeliness of it insofar as, you know, your religion, your heritage. But for me, the most unlikely part of it was that a public intellectual was voted to win the Gold Logie. Was that part of your sense of the unlikeliness of the moment?
Yeah, that I think I said... I can't remember everything I said in the speech, but I think I alluded to the idea that I never thought I would win the Logie, but not in a way that meant, you know, who, me, but more like, no, I'm not made for this. Like, I've always kind of held the view that if you had to design a TV presenter not to win a Logie, I'm pretty much what you would get, right? And for that, partly for that reason, yeah, it's very strange. Like, I'm proud of having won it, but the reason I think I can afford to be proud of having won it is the way that I won it, like what I did to win it. I didn't become a soap star, nothing against them, but it's just not what I am. And so I didn't have to transform into something else in order to win it, which I think was remarkable. I suspect lightning will not strike twice. I suspect this may never happen again unless the TV landscape changes and there are a lot more analysts and commentators hosting things on commercial TV.
Was there part of you that didn't want to win that Gold Logie and wanted Lee Lin Chin to win it instead?
Well, I think everyone wanted Lee Lin Chin to win it on some level.
No, clearly not.
Well, no, because if the voting happened after the shortlist came out, who knows what would have happened. But there wasn't a part of me that didn't want to win it. Like, it's not as though I was trying to shun it or anything like that. I would have been perfectly happy to see other people win it. I would have been, obviously, Lee Lin Chin's an obvious person you would have been delighted to see win it. Would have been delighted to see Carrie win it again. But at no point did I feel like, well, I'm above this.
It's more like a further intrusion on your privacy. Well, though,
a little bit, but
life.
That had already happened. If there was anything to stop, it was the nomination or the being a finalist, whatever it's called. That was the moment where things changed from that, you know, that's when the paparazzi started showing up and things like that. Win or lose wouldn't have made any difference to that.
It is voted. It's an audience vote thing, and there's something that makes that kind of a rock-solid thing in a way.
Yeah.
It's not given to you by the industry. I mean, Channel 10's got you on the show, and good for them. My wife was an actress for some years. Yeah. She's Singaporean-Chinese background. Yeah. And she was often being told by executive producers, oh, Asians don't act that way. Asians do this. Asians do that. Mm. Does that resonate with you in some way?
Yeah, it does. I mean, not as an actor, obviously, because I'm not that. And partly because I'm not an actor in a perverse way, I'm freed from that sort of stuff. You know, I made reference in my speech to Mustafa, who that was entirely organic. He just happened to run into me before I had to give that speech, and it was top of my mind what had just happened. And he was excited for me because I didn't have to change my name. But I suspect part of that is that my role meant that that was just irrelevant. I'm not playing a character. I'm therefore not able to be maneuvered into a box that already exists. I mean,
you own your own lines, in other words.
In a way, yeah. You know, when I'm in the middle of an interview, I'm in the middle of an interview, and that's the way it is. When I'm asked for comment on something, and it's me that's asked for comment. You know, and you still get boxed, and TV is an inherently boxing medium. You get very little time to do anything with the format and all that. Like, I get the inherent limitations, but I'm being me in my own name, and that does change the way it works. And so I do completely understand that experience of being boxed, but I do also appreciate that I'm free from it in certain ways, which I really value.
Have you noticed that if you give everyday Australians the chance to say who is on TV as opposed to executive producers, the first two series of Australian Idol, the winner was a Malay Australian.
Yeah.
The second winner was an Aboriginal Australian.
Exactly. So reality TV is a really good example of that. I've often said the only place you find non-white people on Australian TV seems to be reality TV. Because you can't stop them cooking. You know, you can't stop them being good at that stuff. And so they get cast because that's just the natural talent pool. It begins to reflect Australia a lot more. Okay, and that's great. But you're right. What then about the casting that is more manufactured? Someone I know who works within TV just made a brilliant observation to me. He was talking about the Sydney market specifically and just said the problem with commercial TV in Sydney is that it's people from the eastern suburbs deciding what people from the western suburbs want to see. And so there's not really a clear... It's this weird pantomime that goes on. It's this manufactured thing. And it's great that that can slowly be overcome. And I think eventually it will be. But I mean, we've seen it happen in the US. We've seen it happen in the UK. Australia's just a bit slower at dealing with that.
When you're writing a TV editorial for the project, that's what you call it.
Within the show, we call them Well-Editorials.
Well-Editorial,
but we would never go public with that. I would never, for example, divulge that on air.
When you're writing a Well-Editorial, who are you writing it for?
Partly for me. And this actually applies probably more to my writing in print than TV, which is a different, much more performative medium. But whenever I'm writing anything, I'm trying to get to the bottom of what I think about it. I'm not really writing as an act of advocacy, even though I'm aware that that's the way it will be received. I'm more writing it as analysis, and part of undertaking that analysis is for me to work out what I think of things in the world and how I come to understand the world. That's my main motivation. TV is slightly different because, as I say, it's a performative medium. And I don't write these alone. You know, I write them with a producer. Usually that's Tom Whitty, who I've done a lot of them with. And often with TV, there's an emotional element to it. And so you are inevitably, I guess, writing it for the audience and trying to communicate to them sometimes the importance of an issue. Sometimes it's an issue they've heard of, but, you know, they don't care enough about. Or sometimes it's an issue they've never heard of, and you're trying to introduce them to that, and you're trying to hook them in emotionally. But even in a performative medium like that, there is a part of me that is doing this for me so that I can grasp the issue in a better way. Because I find you actually don't understand much about anything until you're forced to write about it. And it's amazing how your grasp of an issue or your reckoning with an issue can come to fruition once you start writing in a way that it never has before. Speaking doesn't do it. Conversation doesn't do it. Broadcasting something unwritten doesn't do it. Like with print, I've gone into articles thinking I've got this fantastic idea and discovered by about paragraph 3 that it's a crap idea. And I only discovered that because the writing process has forced me to think through the fourth level implications of what it is that I have said and how I'm now completely at odds with some other point that I wanted to make.
Does that mean you can change your mind easily?
Easily enough. And I think that's important. I think if you cannot change your mind, I don't know that you have much of a mind to change. What you have is a series of dogmatic conclusions, and that's that. You have to be able to change your mind.
How much does being married help you be open to changing your mind?
I haven't changed my mind.
Yeah.
Well, it helps me a lot, but perhaps not in the way that your question cheekily implies. So Susan, my wife, is like a really important part of that process for me. Whenever we, I don't know, say we're going to a cafe or whatever, which we do a lot, it's kind of because I work at night, so I don't get to have dinner with her. So that's kind of how our relationship maintains its momentum. But we are constantly kicking around ideas about things and arguments about public issues or whatever it might be. And in that process, we're constantly refining things and I'm being influenced by what she's telling me, and I hope vice versa, although who knows. That relationship is really important and it does help my mental and intellectual formation. And to that extent, minds change or meld, depending on what the case might be.
I think I've noticed in your editorials, both in television and in print, is they often have quite a subtle but a very real appreciation of where power is,
yes,
and where it isn't, too. Yep. And that's the key, I think, to that famous, well, editorial you made about ISIL.
I really do sound like an idiot when say it back to me, don't I?
I know. It helps us put it in a certain context, I suppose. But, yeah. but that really was at the heart of that thought, wasn't it? They're not quite as strong as they look.
Yeah.
Is that something you're always looking at? Where is the power here?
But also, what is the changing nature of power? So my academic background is in terrorism studies, but really more generally it's in social theory. So what I usually do is I take social theory and I apply it to all sorts of subject matter, but most rigorously terrorism, right? That's what I've done in my teaching and my writing and whatever. But in doing that, you are forced always to reckon with power, because social organization is really just a story about the negotiation of power within society, right? That's all politics is. Like, political science doesn't really exist. It's just sociology applied through the prism of power. That's really all it is. But the changing nature of power I also find really interesting. And in terrorism studies, that's really important, right? Because we're now going through an era where traditional conceptions of power, where the nation state is the most powerful thing, we're now seeing that power, it still has lots of conventional power. It still has massive military might and all that sort of stuff. But that massive military might can be brought undone by an insurgency, which doesn't have that sort of conventional power, but it has a very different kind of what I would call liquid power, where it's able to exact a price out of nowhere using almost no weaponry because of its invisibility and its lightness and its flexibility. I mean, 9/11 was a really good example of that. Often when I was with my students, I would begin a lecture by asking them the question, could a nation state have pulled off September 11th. It's an interesting thing to think about.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know that they could. I mean, they could in the sense that mechanically they possibly could, but even that would be difficult because all the spy agencies of the United States are set up to notice things that nation states are doing. It's set up to monitor nation state weaponry. And the consequences of a nation state doing that are so enormous because the United States would have such enormous conventional power that they would just turn around and smash that nation state, as they did to Iraq and as they did to Afghanistan anyway. But a terrorist group's not subject to any of that. So 9/11, like the most enormous terrorist attack on US soil ever, the biggest terrorist attack in the world in history, this was perpetrated by 19 guys with box cutters. That is telling you something about the changing nature of power. That's telling you that terrorists, a small group of people, they don't have conventional power. Their power comes from being unconventional. It comes from being indetectable. It comes, or undetectable, I'm not sure what the correct word is. It comes from these sorts of amorphous, swarm-like properties of power, rather than the sledgehammer form of power that the state has. So when I was talking about ISIL being weak, the point I was trying to make was, what ISIL's trying to sell us is this notion that it is a behemoth, that it's conquered all this territory in the Middle East and it's establishing this state that is just unstoppable as a military force. And the point is, no, it's not remotely unstoppable. It's eminently stoppable. It's being stopped right now. We could probably, if we really cared about nothing else, we could probably get rid of the territorial entity that we call ISIS or ISIL or whatever we call it. We could probably do that within a week. The reason we don't is that there are all sorts of consequences to doing that that might result in more terrorism. That is, that they would be exercising or it would unleash something that uses a different kind of power. But it's not strong in the way that they're asking us to believe.
One of its great weaknesses, seems to me, is that their ultimate goal is completely unfeasible, which is a global caliphate.
Yeah.
That's never going to happen.
No.
Really, it's not realistic. Isn't ultimately that another weakness of an organisation like ISIL?
Well, it is and it isn't, right? It is in that they're doomed to failure. It isn't in that it constantly gives them a project that they can be working towards and inspiring other people to help.
Right, our work is never done, in other words. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when that's the case, you now have an engine. But, I mean, the engine is spluttering. It's losing a lot of territory. And there are a lot of things that they're not prepared to tell you about their situation, like the fact that they're losing huge amounts of territory, like the fact that they're actually not in control of the terrorism that's happening. Now, the Paris attacks, which was the event that triggered that particular piece of television, that was one where there was, it turned out in the end, there was a connection to ISIS. But there are a lot of other attacks that have no direct connection at all. It's just somebody who's decided to go grab a flag and take it on. Now, ISIS will appropriate that because it allows them to project a power, a conventional power, that they just don't have. And my point is that the way we talk about ISIS only reinforces that. And all I really wanted to do with that editorial was explain to people that we are perpetuating their propaganda. Our choice whether or not we want to do that, and apparently there are some people who do want to do that, despite declaring that they hate ISIS. My question is, why would you want to do that?
There's nothing new in this kind of terrorism. There's a great Barbara Tuchman book I'm sure you're familiar with called The Proud Tower, where she devotes several chapters to the great terrorism scare, well, the reality of terrorism in the late 19th, early 20th century over anarchists.
Yeah.
Anarchists were committing bomb attacks, assassinations throughout Europe and the United States.
Killed a president.
Killed the Tsar,
which was the beginning of that whole wave, yeah.
There's some great similarities, it seems to me, there to Islamist terrorism as well. What are some of the kind of underlying similarities you might see between such attacks? Is it a kind of utopian project at the end of it?
Yeah, so terrorism, modern terrorism, which begins really with that wave, like that 19th century anarchist wave out of Russia, I mean, that has belonged to just about every different ideological stripe you can think of. It's been left, it's been right, it's been nationalist, it's been globalist, it's been secular.
It's been religious.
Well, it's been overwhelmingly secular, actually. So if you read through the history of terrorism that David Rappaport famously provides, where he talks about the four waves of modern terrorism, his fourth wave he designates as the religious wave, which begins with probably the sarin gas attacks in Tokyo, the Shinrikyo attacks in, what was that, 95, I think? Mm. That's, for him, the beginning of the religious wave. You could point to other things in the 80s and the early 90s in the Middle East, but that's the standout example that triggers this wave. He identifies a religious wave precisely because it's unusual, because the previous waves were not that. The first wave was an anarchist wave. The second wave he describes as a post-colonial wave after World War I, when all these parcels of land were being split up. The third wave is around in the 60s, where you get the new left wave, you know, the Weathermen, that sort of the Bader Meinhof gang.
But what they all have in common is this desire to build a perfect world,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah. Well, or just separatism. So that's the post-colonial wave. It's just self-determination. We want our land, get off our land, stop governing us. But yes, there is a utopian streak that underlies the anarchist wave, that underlies the new left wave, and underlies, although there is diversity within the Islamist wave, part of what the Islamist terrorist project is about. Yes, there's this utopian ideal we are trying to bring into being. That's the message that's being sold. And ISIS, and Al-Qaeda to an extent, but ISIS represents the most full logical extension of that. It's the most utopian, over-ambitious worldview that they're trying to sell or plan for the world. Before that, Islamist terrorists were actually territorially confined. They wanted to attack their particular nation state, so they'd attack the Egyptian state or the Algerian state or whatever it was. And they were kind of conventional in that way. But you're right. There are ideological similarities that stretch across time that span the secular and the religious and the national and the global and all of these sorts of things.
Yeah, it seems to me the worst thing in the world we have to deal with is people who want purity. And when actually we're such bent and flawed creatures, we can't possibly be pure.
Yeah.
Therefore, we'll always fail that test, won't we?
Yeah. So this is one of the reasons I've always had quite a deep sympathy with conservative political philosophy, because that's the central conceit or the central commitment of the conservative.
Except that we're broken and flawed.
Yeah. Do not try to perfect things. Perfectibility is a utopian revolutionary project. It's a progressive ideal, which is why Hitler is a progressive or was a progressive. What he was trying to do was bring about, he was trying to remake the world in accordance with some kind of perfect design. That's the essence of progressivism, and I don't like that idea.
What about progress through democratic means, step-by-step, non-violent change, that kind of thing?
Well, you could argue that that's a fairly conservative way to achieve progress. Right, which is the central idea of... Well, I've now got multiple central ideas. So this is why writing's good. You pick out that sort of contradiction.
I know, things are going to stay the same, things have to change.
Yeah,
the old thought.
Yeah. So, but what conservatives are saying is that change should happen through organic means, that it should happen through evolution.
You actually think... As spectacular as the September 11 attacks were,
yeah.
The attacks on London in the tube and public transport in 2005 were actually even more significant than September 11. Can you just explain your thinking why those London attacks, less visually spectacular, yeah. were more significant?
Because they broke the mold of what we thought terrorism was and the way that it worked. 9/11 was cinematic. The scale of it we'd never seen before. Couldn't really imagine outside of a Hollywood studio. And then it happened, and it was horrific and hard for us to emotionally cope with. But it wasn't actually hard for us to deal with intellectually, because it was still fitting that model of a group of people from outside who belong to a structured terrorist network come in to a country and execute an attack. We've got our head around that. What the London bombings did was change that logic. These were a group of people who grew up within the United Kingdom, whose identity politics meant that they were no longer anchored within that territory, or actually, frankly, any territory at all. They had what some sociologists, particularly in France, talk about as a deterritorialized identity. It's like an abstract global form of identity. And they were able to perpetrate an attack without being embedded within the guts of a structured terrorism organization, although they had a connection, but not, they weren't in the middle of it. They were able to undertake an attack on their own country.
The enemy within attacking people as they go about their day-to-day lives.
Right, but disconnected from the understanding we'd have of a very clear top-down terrorist organization. We've kind of always, and we've been able to do this because historically it's played out this way, we've kind of always understood terrorism as being akin to like a corporation. You take out the CEO and then the thing will fall over. You attack the leadership and the thing falls over. Once Al-Qaeda and its really varied decentralized expressions of Al-Qaeda, such as the London attacks, once that phenomenon came along, that strategy of just attacking the leaders and hoping the terrorism organization would go away manifestly didn't work. In fact, terrorism only increased as a result of that. We killed Bin Laden, what, 5 years ago? The problem's only gotten worse. Now, the thing with that is that that shouldn't happen if terrorism follows the old model of a really clear structure. So what London did was really introduce to our consciousness this idea of homegrown terrorism, where people are radicalized at a distance with relatively little training, relatively little connection to, you know, the terrorist organization overseas. And that changed everything. It collapsed the distinction that we've just been trained to draw between what is domestic and what is foreign.
They start to resemble the old Marvel Comics organization, Hydra. Cut off one head, two more grow in its place.
Yeah, and so we're playing whack-a-mole with this problem. Afghanistan's a problem, so we'll smash Afghanistan, and then Iraq's a problem, even though it wasn't, as it turns out.
Yes.
We'll smash that. And hang on now, what's happening in Somalia? Okay, what's happening in
Syria,
Yemen? Pakistan's this thing now. Oh, hang on, London's this. And our failure to understand how liquid this thing is, this is what I meant by liquid power. It's our failure to understand how liquid this thing is has meant that we've misconceived the problem. Like George W. Bush made that I think, what should now be an infamous statement, where he said, it's better that we kill the terrorists in Baghdad than in Boston. And then a decade later, a bomb goes off in Boston. And that happens because the threat doesn't fit the shape that, in our mind, it had always fit.
How did those London attacks, to your mind, change the conversation about multiculturalism in places like the UK and in Australia?
Well, especially, I mean, the UK was kind of obvious. It's interesting that we took on the same conversation. But yeah, what it did was it meant that multiculturalism suddenly became a national security issue rather than an issue of cultural cohesion. Once upon a time, if you didn't like multiculturalism, you were probably likely to say things like they're taking jobs or whatever. It was kind of grounded. There's a difference between saying they eat funny foods and take our jobs on the one hand and saying they're going to kill us on the other. It just completely changes the nature of the conversation. And so what happened after the London bombings is why London was so significant, particularly for Australia, was it meant that as terrorism became something we understood as coming from within, multiculturalism itself found itself in the dock. So it's to blame for these national security concerns that we have. Now, that's a misguided analysis, and I can go on at length about that.
But here's the thing. One of the main things motivating the terrorists themselves is a horror of multiculturalism. They seem to hate it more than anyone.
Well, in its way, in the sense that they're culturally supremacists.
Don't mix, don't mingle. Certainly don't intermarry.
Although some do, some have led perfectly, what look like perfectly integrated lives, and then we've since discovered that they were planning this sort of thing in the background.
Previous to that, they've given it away and walked away from it. He became withdrawn in the last 2 years.
Which is
stopped hanging out, stopped playing cricket, stopped doing all these other things.
Which is a common feature of the radicalization process. No, that's true. But I think there are so many elements to the multiculturalism conversation that ensued that I just thought made no sense. I mean, the way, for example, that Australia declared that multiculturalism was a failure because of things that happened in Europe, which is a continent that in my mind has never actually tried multiculturalism and may not be capable of trying it because of the way European national identities work.
When you say Australia declared, I don't think Australia ever declared that.
John Howard alluded to it. I mean, he would never say it bluntly like that. But it was very clear he was not a fan of multiculturalism. He famously dropped multiculturalism from the relevant portfolio. It would have been immigration at the time. We no longer have a minister for multiculturalism. I think maybe the opposition have a multiculturalism spokesperson now at the federal level, but there's no minister for it. That's gone. The idea that multiculturalism was something that was divisive was something very much that John Howard was providing momentum for.
I think Australian multiculturalism is very robust, and the thing that undergirds it is intermarriage. I think most people have got a stake in the scheme of things. Even older Australians have got Eurasian or mixed heritage grandchildren now. And you're going to tell them their grandchildren's less than perfect?
I mean,
it's a kind of an organic thing now in Australia.
And that's the thing. I think multiculturalism is stuck in Australia precisely because it's organic, but also because Australia is an open concept. It's not a very clear concept. What is it that makes something Australian? It's not clear, but it's open. It's accessible in a way that being French isn't or being German isn't. And Europe has always been set up in a way that has made that kind of easy integration, not within a society, but within the national mythology. That's difficult in Europe because, well, depends how far you want to go back, but with the Treaties of Westphalia that created, in the end, the nation states of Europe as we now know them, the only way to make that work, to move from empires to nation states, was to create a mythology that each nation state expressed something essential and unified and distinct from every other nation state. And so national identity in Europe inevitably, and often for good reason, like good pragmatic reason at the time, but inevitably meant that it was gathered around language and race and ethnicity and even religious denomination. So if you said you were from a particular country, I could immediately, without seeing you, tell you what your skin color was, probably your eye color and your hair color, what church you went to, what language you spoke, and so on. So national identity became inherently ethnicized. Australia doesn't quite have that because we're too young a country for that. And as you say, because of that lived experience, everyone's from everywhere. So it's just too hard to maintain that mythology. I mean, we try. There are elements within Australia that we'll try and always try, but it doesn't quite work in the same way.
Just two examples that have popped up in the culture in recent years. One is the phenomenon that is Nazim Hussain, who I'm a big fan of, walking around as Uncle Sam, campaigning for Australia to take on Sharia law. He's like a Muslim Norman Gunston.
Yes.
And getting people to say extraordinary things as a result, taking the piss. And another incident I saw on election night was Sam Dastyari
inviting
Pauline Hanson to come and have a halal snack pack.
Yeah.
And she primly said, no, thank you.
Not happening.
Who was more Aussie in that moment?
Dastyari or Hanson?
Yeah. I mean, didn't he look like a bit more of a, you know, a whiskey leg puller?
Yeah. What Dastyari captured in that moment, I haven't thought about this until you just raised it, but what he captured in that moment is, I think, the central Australian trope, and that is irreverence. We're not actually egalitarian in the sense of being equal. Like, we don't believe in equality so much. We are not anti-authoritarian. Actually, we're quite comfortable with authority and we acquiesce to authority very easily. But we are irreverent. It's what John Hurst called an egalitarianism of manners.
There are plenty of journos and pundits out in the world who say, Waleed Ali needs to say this. Yeah. Waleed Ali needs to say that, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Does it feel sometimes when these conversations are being played out in opinion columns that you're in the room and a bunch of people are talking about you like you're not in that room?
Yeah, all the time. But to be honest, I don't see those things very often because I just don't. I find them so overwhelmingly uninteresting that I have better things to read. So I just don't. It doesn't really make much difference. But yeah, I think the reason that stuff happens is that to these people, I am not allowed simply to be a broadcaster or a commentator or even an academic. I'm a symbol for something, and they will compete over what I'm a symbol for. It has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with what I actually think or believe or what I think I am. I'm just appropriated for these various, you know, people who like me will appropriate me as well, and people who don't. Like, to some extent, that's the nature of being a public figure. But in my case, because there are so few people who fit the categories that I fit, particularly around race and religion and so on, in the public domain, except as villains, I just get appropriated for all these causes. So once I become a symbol of whatever it might be, in my capacity as that symbol, must do this or they are dissatisfied with me living out that symbol.
It seems that people who make those kind of remarks want to see more Australian Muslims not just declare loyalty, but affection for Australian values, freedom of speech, in a way of, and that's you're that guy, really. You are that guy that they seem to be calling for, but that doesn't seem to satisfy them.
They don't want that.
They don't want that. Maybe they want you to be Ayaan Hirsi Ali and to renounce your faith.
Yeah, it's clearly reached a point now where the only way a Muslim can be accepted to a certain kind of commentator is no longer to be a Muslim. Like, or to say they're a Muslim but hate everything about Islam. That's what's demanded. And at that point, you just go, well, this is stupid. I'm not actually playing this guy. A, I'm not accountable to you. B, I don't know how relevant you are to my life or really to anyone or anything, really. And C, this is not a negotiation.
When Mark Scott became managing director of the ABC, Mark's a practicing Christian.
Yeah.
And, you know, even I did this when I interviewed him. I felt obliged. I ought to ask him how far his Christian values may or may not intrude upon a secular public broadcaster.
Yeah.
And I felt a little odd doing that, to be honest, because I knew that they weren't
going
to. But is this robust secularism or what? What is this, to your mind?
I just think it's how we express our varying biases. That's all.
What do you mean?
Well, if we lived in a country that was secular, but where being a Christian in public was a fairly normal thing, you would not even think of asking that question, despite the secularity of that country. Like, in America, you wouldn't ask that.
It goes the other way.
Probably, which expresses a different bias. You asking that question of a public figure, to what extent are you going to bring your Christianity into this? They probably actually feel obliged to say, well, quite a lot.
Right? Well, that's the truth, isn't it? Yeah. I suppose your moral outlook is inevitably intertwined with your faith,
surely. But that's all we're dealing with. Certain perspectives that are admissible and certain ones that are not admissible within the court of whatever this is. That's all that's happening. And so that's how we express bias. So, okay, you're a Christian, but you better not be too Christian. It's kind of what we're saying. Yeah, those sorts of things happen all the time. But what's interesting about that, and I obviously experienced this for the reasons you were talking to me about before, it actually stands in the way of you being a person and being you. It's like, okay, well, I know this characteristic of you, and as a result of that, I'm going to view everything through that the prism of that characteristic, and I'm going to attribute to that a whole bunch of, I don't know, concerns or controversies or commitments.
I've already done that with you over you being a Richmond fan. You know that,
yeah,
don't you?
But I mean, that's fair enough. Right. But you see the problem. What it effectively means is, in order to gain admission into the conversation, you have to do this sort of weird declaratory performance about certain things. I think the thing that really annoys certain people about me is I just refuse to play that game. Like, as far as I'm concerned, I turn up every weekday, there's a camera on me, and I have to talk to it, and I have to cover issues that are in the news and in public affairs, and I have to do that to the best of my ability, bearing in mind what the interests of the audience are likely to be and what the live issues at the heart of any news story are. That's what I do. It's as simple as that.
We were talking about power earlier, and liquid power or soft power.
Yeah.
And here's kind of an anecdote that's quite revealing, I think. Our mutual friend Scott Stevens, who
yes.
you co-host The Minefield with, told me that recently he was in his local corner shop, and a lady who he doesn't know, he's never met before, was looking at the milk fridge, grabbed him by the arm and said, "Now, which was the milk that Waleed said was the good milk and which was the bad milk?" That is power. That is power of a kind. I always get this sense with you, you're deeply uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
Like, in fact, you always want to change the subject and don't like talking
about
that.
Have I been doing that?
Yeah, well, yeah, generally, even in private conversation with you, you're a bit like very uncomfortable with that feeling of the kind of soft power that has accrued to you just by virtue of you having a generous public voice on a whole lot of matters.
You're right about the discomfort. Like, a lot of my lowest professional experiences come after what people would deem to be the greatest successes.
Why?
Because I think what it is I don't like seeing something I've said or done take on a life of its own that feels to me like it has nothing to do with what I've said or done. Now, the milk thing's a different example because that piece we ended with a very specific list of things you could do, which, by the way, we didn't make up. They were things that farmers had explained to us. So we were really just passing on their voice. So actually, it's their voice that was the powerful one. But the Sonia Kruger one, which I still don't think of as the Sonia Kruger one, because it wasn't actually about Sonia Kruger. It was about the nature of public interaction. Anyway, but leave that to aside. Let's call it that. The Sonia Kruger one, the ISA one, whatever. They were horrible weeks for me.
Why?
Because these things become something that, in my mind, they're not. And then they become about me rather than about the issue at hand. I was really uncomfortable after the ISIL editorial because everyone wanted to talk about me and what I'd said. And I'm like, a bomb's just gone off. And there's something important to understand about ISIL. And I'm quoting directly from their magazine. They're telling us stuff that we're ignoring, that if we paid attention to, would make this transparent. And for some reason, everyone wants to talk about who said this or who passed this on. Like I was just providing a piece of commentary or analysis on it. I'm not the issue, guys. Like, the discomfort you talk about, I think, comes from the fact that people assume that I'm trying to change the world, and I'm not. I think I'm comfortable with the idea of the world changing. I think there are things about the world that need to change. I think there are conversations we need to have about certain things in the world. But I'm not trying to change the world. I don't want me to be the one that's changing the world. I would not trust me to change it. All I'm doing is trying to provide a piece of analysis or commentary on a thing, and I'm trying to do it the best I can. And there are times where it catches fire and goes viral, as the young folk like to say. And that becomes a thing, but that's not what I'm striving for. But everything becomes perceived as that. And I think that's where the discomfort comes from. It's the way that things and motivations get attributed to me, and the issue that I'm trying to talk about sometimes just seems to get lost.
About 5 years ago, I went to the United States to meet a whole bunch of people making these really popular NPR programs. And after a little while, they would kind of quietly and shyly admit to me how bored and disgusted they are by America's culture wars, this kind of shouty screaming match, national screaming match that's played out in its national media.
Yeah.
And they've all found there's this huge longing, huge appetite for a much more civil conversation and an appetite for making radio about shared sympathies with people whose lives you normally wouldn't know about or understand.
Yeah.
I think that's what you've tapped into as well.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you think that, because that I take that as far more complimentary but also far more consonant with my own aims than the description of me as, you know, some kind of warrior for something.
Or prophet or something like that.
Yeah.
But what about if you're just simply giving voice to some quietly held civic values that a lot of us share but that tend to become incoherent in moments of fear?
Yeah, but I've also become... unfashionable is not the right word. They don't fit within the logic of contemporary media making, which suggests that the way to become relevant is to shout loudly and to manufacture conflict so that there's a media drama. I don't like that. I feel like it's a cynical tactic that then allows us to pretend we've had a debate when we haven't. There's not even been an engagement.
What if more than being cynical, what if it's just wrong? I
mean, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
when
yeah.
I started in radio, the orthodoxy was don't make an interview go past 7 minutes.
Yes. And now, like, you take the Milk editorial, that went 7 minutes.
Yeah. Like, the show goes for an hour.
Yes. Well, we'll take out ads, 45 minutes or whatever.
No,
our
ads.
Show. Yeah, no, your show.
That's take why my show's better than yours, Wally.
Is that right?
I think that's right.
Sorry, I missed. Where's that? Do you have a gold statue?
Not yet, but I'm scoping for it in your house.
Yeah, right.
Sadly, it has your name on it.
Yeah, right. You could just replace the badge. So this is what I've felt about the editorial stuff that has become a thing in my work. I feel like even the fact that they've gone well or better than I expected they would go, I think that's misunderstood by a lot of people. I think they think that it has been successful because it's someone staring down the barrel and ranting at you. And I don't actually think that's why people have responded. I think they've responded because it's been radical enough to take 7 minutes to talk about something that's a little bit complicated and lay it out. So my feeling is, wouldn't it be great if we had an ethic in media that was not everyone's entitled to their opinion, but was instead everyone's entitled to whatever opinion they can argue for? Like, I think it's subtle, but hugely different, I think. And I think what the editorials are trying to do, at least, and sometimes they're not successful in this, sometimes they are, but what I think they're trying to do is not stand up and tell you an opinion, but reason with you so that by the time the opinion is ultimately expressed, it's earned. Right? This idea that it's taking the audience into an issue and saying, all right, let's begin with here. Here are some facts about this for context. Here are some relevant things that are overlooked, or here's the part of this story that is actually outrageous, or here's the technical thing that you may not understand because it's obscured in the way that this debate proceeds, or whatever it might be, and I'll run you through it as best I can within the confines of a commercial TV format. And then at the end, I will say, here is the conclusion. And you can reject that conclusion, but you know how I've reached it. I've always been far more interested in how someone gets to a conclusion than in the conclusion itself. And I actually feel deep down, so are audiences.
I have a suspicion at the moment that the old ideas that have hung around in the Western world since the end of the Cold War are starting to unravel.
Totally, yeah.
You think so as well?
Yeah.
And I think the question is this decade going to be like the 1930s or the 1970s? Is it going to really unravel, or is it going to sort of come back together again around a new set of ideas? What are your thoughts on that?
I can't adjudicate on whether it's the 30s or the 70s. The weaponry is different now. One of the consequences of the changing nature of power that I spoke about before is that serious damage can be inflicted by people who don't have the conspicuous markings of power or privilege. But the underlying condition, I think, that you identify is certainly what I identify, which is that the political orthodoxies, the political assumptions that have defined the 20th century, particularly once the Cold War got underway in earnest and then when it ended, this idea of political decision-making being relegated to a kind of market form of reasoning, a market rationality. That's now under huge assault, but there is nothing yet to replace it. And so when I look at all of those sort of atavistic or nativist responses, whether they take the form of various kinds of Brexiteers, not all of them, but some of them, or they take the form of Trump, or they take the form of Hansenism here, or even if they take the form of ISIS, which is, you know, it's obviously different in scale and whatever, but a similar impulse, you know. I think because over the past 30 years, we have slowly withered away all the genuine points of solidarity and belonging, social belonging, that once undergirded a society. When we reach for that, when we reach for some kind of expression of solidarity and usness, all we can come up with is something that finds a them, because the us is now incoherent. We're so fractured, we're so diverse, we're so individualistically trained. We've become so incapable of generosity to people, towards people that we don't understand or we don't like. We've lost so much of our mythology of togetherness and solidarity that when we search for it, the us isn't there. So it's easier to construct an us by pointing it at them. That's all Trump's doing.
Just finally, talking once again to our mutual friend Scott Stephen. Scott was saying one of the things that is not really well understood about monotheism is this idea that God is so big. Really, the only rational way you can respond to it is with a kind of humility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think it's one of the most misunderstood things about religion generally, often by religious people. that if religion is a source of arrogance, you are doing it horrifically wrongly. Really what you're doing then is an identity project, and that's not what that should be about. Humility is a necessary consequence, I think, of like proper, like traditional religious commitment. It's recognizing your own smallness. I think it's really important. I mean, particularly in the kind of industry we work in, right? Perhaps more the industry I work in than the one you work in with. It's, you know, lights and makeup and red carpets and that sort of thing. But yeah, I think human beings would do really well if they could recognize their own smallness a lot more. But we're in the process, religious and irreligious people, everybody, is in the process of building a culture that is all about our own bigness, our own consequence, our own significance, that we as individuals are kind of lords over our respective domains. And I think that's character deforming. I think it's socially corrosive, but that's kind of where we're heading.
Thank you for having me in your home, Waleed.
No worries. Anytime. Well, not anytime. I mean,
not anytime, I was just going to say.
Sometimes we have to sleep.
I'll be down in Melbourne next week with the family if we could crash.
Yeah,
that'd
be great. Well, if you can find a spot.
On air, online, and on your mobile, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
And here's hoping Li Lin Chin picks up the gold logie next year. Waleed Ali is, of course, the co-host of Channel 10's current affairs show, The Project. What's less well known is he's also the co-host, alongside Scott Stephens, of ABC Radio National's completely excellent The Minefield, which is about navigating the moral and ethical minefield of modern life. It's one of my favourite Australian podcasts. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.